Arizona News Radio. The evacuation ordered in Springerville and Eager's been expanded. The 390,000-acre wildfire causing some more spot fires.
The fire is in fuels that are already dry.
Firefighters also battling the Murphy Fire, 67,000 acres, 25% contained near Aravaca, and the Horseshoe 2 Fire, 104,000 acres outside a portal. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms offering a reward for what they think now is an arson fire at the Greer Lodge last month.
We're soliciting information from the White Mountain community for any information they may have with regarding to the arson.
Four suspects in custody for a home burglary and surprise.
Two of which were adults, two were minors.
And a missing 18-year-old woman from Phoenix found safe at a friend's home.
Location I won't give out because obviously it's just a resident's home, but she was located here in Phoenix.
George Tanner, Arizona News.
And this KFNX traffic report is brought to you by Preparation H. 19th Avenue north of the 10 has a collision. So does the right shoulder southbound of the Black Canyon right at Jefferson Street. And you're going to find some slow-and-go traffic on the 51 heading northbound between McDowell and Northern. New Preparation H totables. Discreet little tubes packed with big relief. They're the Anywhere Preparation H. From the brand doctors recommend most by name among leading brands.
Jim Howell from the KFNX Weather Center. We're going to remain below normal as we enter our second week of the month. Looks like about 98 tomorrow. And then we may see 100 by Friday afternoon, but we keep it in the upper 90s over the weekend. We're breezy down here in the valley and windy at times in the high country. Jim Howell, KFNX News Talk Radio, 1100.
And currently in our downtown studios, we're sitting at 95 degrees. Next news in 30 minutes. And when it breaks here on KFNX News Talk Radio, 1100.
Could switching to GEICO really save you 15% or more on car insurance? Is trying to sneak out of a really boring meeting wearing tap shoes a bad idea?
Sales growth has increased 2.9%. That's a reflection of aggressive... Ben, where are you going?
Nowhere. Headed back to my seat now.
Switch to GEICO now and you could save hundreds on your car insurance. For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
Could switching to GEICO really save you 15% or more on car insurance? Does a rolling stone gather no moss? No moss. You're gonna have to trust me on this one.
Switch to GEICO now and you could save hundreds on your car insurance. For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
This is Legalese, where the law is always on your side. Now introducing your host, a longtime veteran of the courts, Dennis Willinchek.
Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, and it's a little bit after 4, and we're here at KFNX News Talk Radio, 277 KFNX. And this week, we're going to be talking with Joe Canefield, who is a new incoming bar president of the State Bar of Arizona, as well as has just left the job of general counsel for the governor's office and counsel to the governor. And a little bit about Joe here. He received a Bachelor of Science degree in economics from Arizona State University and a JD at his law degree from the University of Arizona. And Joe has taught election law at the University of Arizona James Rogers College of Law in Tucson and is an editorial board member of the Arizona Attorney magazine, where he's written several articles on Arizona election law for the magazine. Joe's career as counsel to the governor has many interesting stories, I'm sure, attached to it that we'll be exploring over the hour. As counsel, he provided legal advice directly to Governor Brewer of all legislation to be signed by the governor, as well as drafting of executive orders, guidance, and judicial appointments, and advised the governor in pending state litigation, which we'll be talking about on various issues. Before that, Joe had advised the governor at the elections department, and we'll be also discussing some cases that arose out of that function. Currently, Joe has just recently left the office of the governor to be a partner in the Phoenix office of the national law firm Ballard Spahr in downtown Phoenix, and we'll be talking to him about that transition. He's an acting partner in the litigation department and a member of the Government Relations, Regulatory Affairs, and Contracting Group. And his practice is focused now on government relations, civil and appellate litigation, public and private partnerships, administrative law, gaming, and tax matters. And his specialties are election law, campaign finance, constitutional law, and state and local tax and government administration. One of the interesting things we'll be discussing with Joe in a minute is not only his service as president-elect of the State Bar next week at the Bar Convention, he'll be inducted, but also recently he was appointed as counsel, one of the counsel, one of the two counsel, I believe, on the Redistricting Commission, two counsel of the Redistricting Commission. We'll talk to him about that in just a second. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dennis. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. And as I said, you have a very, very interesting background. So I think what I'd like to do is basically start, if you don't mind, at the time that you were in the Elections Department, which is where I think I first met you. And I think we met in the Proposition 200 case, which is about to be argued by Tom Horn, I believe, at the end of the month. That's the case dealing with a voter identification and proof of identification, which, by the way, I just noticed there was an article in the paper, I believe the Wisconsin governor, if I'm not mistaken, was signing a similar bill into law just the other day, if not today. I can't remember exactly when I saw that, but I did note it. So there are now a few states that have now adopted this, and, of course, as we sit for our listening audience, it's in a state of flux. It's going to be heard en banc, that is, by all the judges up in the Ninth Circuit. And you were integrally involved in that case, weren't you?
I was. That was a voter initiative passed by the voters in 2004, if I recall correctly. Now Arizona requires, as a result of this initiative, that voters show proof of identification when voting at the polls. And also when registering to vote, they have to provide evidence of United States citizenship. Not surprisingly, there are groups and others and individuals that opposed that law, felt that it was discriminatory against certain individuals and populations, challenged it. And Governor Brewer, then Secretary of State Brewer, and I worked on defending Proposition 200 through the courts. And, of course, as you mentioned, that's where you and I first met. And we were very successful, frankly, from the very beginning. Part of that success, I think, really is attributed to Governor Brewer, who, as then the chief election official for the state of Arizona, took it upon herself to make sure that these identification provisions were implemented in a very fair way, quickly recognized that they were necessary to preserving the integrity of our election system. I mean, prior to Proposition 200 and the voter ID provisions, it was really an honor-based system where if you went into the polls and signed in as someone else, and that person never came in to vote, there was really no way of ever knowing whether a fraud was perpetrated on the process. And there were other issues.
Well, you had to do it after the fact, I guess, which made it very difficult, right?
Right, and it made it very difficult to ever track that person down. And I don't want to mislead your listeners into believing there was rampant fraud, because I don't believe there ever was. But there certainly could have been and may have been in some instances, and it was important elections. There's not, you know, arguably in our democracy, I'm not sure what's more important than preserving the integrity of the election process. So, But getting back to the lawsuits, and well, let me back up.
Yeah.
Governor Brewer, you know, like I said, took it upon herself to implement these provisions in a very fair way, providing for rules, identifying what kinds of ID voters could present, and making sure that every voter would have the ability to either have ID with them or obtain that identification. And I think it was very difficult for the challengers to really argue with what she had done. They did their best. The court.
I mean, they were arguing basically, you know, in simplistic form. They were basically a lot of them were Mexican American legal defense funds and so forth. That Hispanic groups, I think, for the most part, that were arguing that really it was targeted at Hispanics. To be fair, that's I think what they were claiming. That the only purpose of the law to require was not to stop, as you say, rampant fraud, but to target preventing illegal immigrants. But today, and I'm trying to find the article here, but for some reason I can't put my hand on it. I think today there was an article, if I'm not mistaken, in the paper about Tom Horn weighing in on the fact that the federal government The Obama administration has now filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, in this pending appellate argument.
And that's disappointing but not surprising. And one thing we should note is that there was two provisions, as I mentioned, identification at the polls, showing ID when you go to the polls to vote, and then this proving your citizenship when you register. The identification at the polls provision has been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, so those challenges are effectively over.
Yeah.
So now what we're fighting,
good point.
And you mentioned, I think we, I don't know if you mentioned on the air before we got on the air, that the governor in Wisconsin and some other states have been signing similar legislation. The only issue remaining in that with respect to Prop 200 is the proof of citizenship component. And up until recently, that had been upheld by the courts.
Yep.
The district court below here in Arizona, Judge Silver upheld it as a President Clinton appointee, as did the first panel of the Ninth Circuit, who first reviewed the constitutional questions and challenges when we were in the injunctive proceedings.
The Supreme Court, I think, it went to the Supreme Court on the injunction, too.
Right, and they sent it right back down and said, what happened was, after the injunctive proceeding was over, trial was on the merits, the court, she reaffirmed her earlier ruling on the injunctions, went back up to the Ninth Circuit, and then they got a different panel. And then
that's because I argued it and lost. In front of Sandra O'Connor.
Well, they did something that was very unusual. You know, a different panel actually reversed a prior panel in the same case, and so that's what Attorney General Horn is about to argue, because the court has taken in what we call an en banc proceeding, where 11 judges of the court are now going to question which panel was right.
Well, interestingly, the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit, which for our listeners is probably, I believe, is the largest circuit in the country. It's a huge circuit, but anyway, so to have all of the judges participate is really something. I don't even know how you do that. But the chief judge was the dissenter on that opinion, if I recall correctly. And that may bode well, I think. And again, Sandra O'Connor being on the panel, but she's, of course, not going to be on the panel this time.
Right. And she was sitting on she can sit on the panel as a retired justice. So she actually was sitting as a Ninth Circuit judge. As I learned after the fact, that the other judge that ruled with her was a former law clerk of hers.
Judge Okuda.
And so it not disregarding for a minute that it was former Justice O'Connor, retired Justice O'Connor, it's still, whoever it was, it raises very interesting questions about whether two panels on the same case can really contradict each other. And it's not like there were facts that changed during the trial. I mean, the legal issue of whether the voting, the citizenship requirement, was preempted by the National Voter Registration Act. It's the same kind of analysis. So really, I think that they should have been more deferential to the earlier panel.
Weren't they really saying, in a nutshell, again, we're not analyzing in great detail here, but essentially the way I recall it, the court was basically saying, as you said, that the Federal Voter Rights Registration Act preempted this, and that the idea of the federal act was to sort of make registering easier, not more difficult. And I say that again in a big summary of it. That's pretty much what they were saying. And that, therefore, our state's act was inconsistent with making it easier. But, you know, one has to wonder, don't you think? I mean, how difficult is it to show a driver's license for the privilege of voting? I mean, 96% of the people have a driver's license, and it's not hard to get one.
Well, exactly. And I don't think the feds were exactly – they were trying to make the process easier and more uniform and to create a process whereby there could be one form that all states use. And but they certainly weren't intending to prevent the states from preserving the integrity of their registration process. And by not being able to go behind what someone just says on the form and look into whether they are in fact over 18 or a citizen of the United States or – any other requirement, not a felon, not a convicted felon. I mean, that's essentially what the feds are arguing, is that now if they say on the form that they're a citizen and they swear to that, then that's, you know, that's enough.
That's enough. We just trust
it. The state shouldn't be allowed to go behind and look deeper, and that's just wrong.
All right, we're going to return in a few minutes. This is Dennis Wolinchek on Legalese with Joe Canfield. We'll be talking about these issues and preemption issues in general with SB 1070 and other interesting issues when we return.
Z Since 1991, the law offices of Willinchek & Bartness have provided quality business litigation service that you'd find at a big firm with small firm atmosphere. Willinchek & Bartness specialize in cases of breach of contract, real estate litigation, construction defect, business fraud, and breach of fiduciary duty. For professional yet very personal legal representation, call Willinchek & Bartness today at 602-606-2810, 602-606-2810.
I'm here to tell you this. If Republicans take that lesson from the defeat in New York 26, they might as well kiss their majority in the House of Representatives goodbye and kiss any hope of retaking the Senate goodbye. Republicans win when Republicans are forceful, on point, persuasive, and talk about these core, these central issues of liberty and American exceptionalism.
Laura Ingraham, mornings at 6 on KFNX.
Hello, my name is Craig Roddle. I am a wealth strategist with CSP Financial Group. I invite you to listen to Heroes Talk Radio every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. where you will learn to plan for a tax-free retirement. At CSP Financial Group, we are experts in maximizing your current assets and growing your retirement accounts. At CSP Financial Group, our experience can help you generate a lifetime income stream. You can visit our website at cspfg.com and listen to Heroes Talk Radio Saturdays at 2 p.m. on KFNX News Talk Radio 1100.
Our company is called SkyPower. We are solar guys. We design, we build solar electric systems. My electric bill last month was like $30. I'm telling you guys now, they work. We've been doing it for years. They cost a whole lot less than you think. You could do it for as little as like $2,000. You want to scale it up to a gajillion dollars? You can do that, but why bother? Solar's real. The best way to find out, have me come on over and let's take a look. Give me a call. I'm at 480-290-2040. Go to our website, which is skypower.co.
Welcome back. This is Dennis Willinchek on Legalese here with Joe Canfield, a lawyer in town who was formerly chief counsel to the governor, as well as incoming bar president and other interesting things he's done in his life. Joe, let's talk about the bar for a minute. Tell me, you become bar president in about a week at the convention, correct?
Correct.
And what does that entail for our listeners? What does that mean?
I'm very proud of my involvement with the State Bar of Arizona, and very truly honored to be president, soon to be president of what I believe is a very fine organization of attorneys in the state. The State Bar president presides over the Board of Governors. It's the governing body of the organization. We're all volunteers. We don't get paid.
Right.
And we set the general policy like any kind of corporate board would do. We have an executive director that is full-time. John Phelps reports to us, and then he's the one who oversees a staff of about 100 folks, attorneys and non-attorneys that primarily run the lawyer regulation in the state, serve as prosecutors. I hate to use that term, but that's really essentially what they're doing for lawyers that violate the rules of professional conduct. Our primary mission, of course, is to keep the public safe and make sure that those that practice law are competent and able to do so in an ethical way. And in addition, we provide a lot of services to the members, law office assistance type programs, ethical advice, continuing legal education programs, and a whole host of other issues. I'm sure if the bar's PR folks are listening to me, they would say, why aren't you mentioning this and that? But there's a lot of stuff.
There's a lot, yeah. Well, one of the things I wanted to talk to you briefly about is not only services that the bar may give to or render to lawyers, but to the public in general. And I noted that there was a story about the Access to Justice Task Force, which I noted you had served on. Maybe you headed it up. I'm not sure. But tell us what that is and how that affects the public.
Well, one of my main interests has always been access to justice, going back to before I even went to law school. I've always believed that in the justice system, if everyone doesn't have equal access, then the system really doesn't work. And I'm not sure anyone would take issue with that. The problem is lawyers are very expensive, which means that folks with lower incomes usually can't afford an attorney to help them out. So I have made it my cause over the last 15, 16 years during my involvement with the state bar to push these issues, to try to figure out ways of making legal services available to those that otherwise couldn't afford them, or maybe could afford them, but it would just eat up a lot of their income. We call these folks of modest means. And I had when I first got on the Board of Governors in the, I think it was 2001, I'd asked the president of the bar at the time if he would consider forming a task force to look at these issues, and he did, and then he made me chair, so no good deed goes unpunished.
Right.
And we looked at ways of trying to get more resources into the hands of lawyers that do this kind of work.
So how does this work in reality? Do the bar members pay an amount or volunteer an amount out of their dues to go to this task force that then is used as a fund to go directly to lawyers to represent indigent people?
Well, the task force was just a subbody of the board, a subcommittee of the board that made recommendations. But one of the recommendations they did make was to give lawyers the ability to voluntarily contribute to the organizations, the legal services organizations that provide legal assistance to indigent individuals. And that program, have, to the credit of our profession, Dennis, lawyers have generously given over the years since we put that program in place. I think we just crossed the $1 million mark, and it's something that I'm very proud of because it's not costing.
We're not
forcing members to pay. It's not like a tax. Members are doing it because it's the right thing to do. And also, in addition to just giving money, which is helpful, but lawyers also volunteer their time.
Right.
We've provided opportunities for them to do that.
Many people don't realize that most lawyers I know actually do that voluntarily or involuntarily. Sometimes they just don't get paid, but but seriously, the lawyers do give of their time to people, and I think all lawyers tend to do that. What are some of the things that you look forward to working on this year as bar president in terms of any goals that you have for the bar?
Well, I think that there's three basic goals or the issues that I'd want to address as president, in addition to just doing the day-to-day stuff that we have to do, which is a lot. But I would like to reconvene the Access to Justice Task Force because it's been a few years since they've gotten together to look at these issues. The economy, of course, has hit folks even harder, and the profession for that matter. But it's time to look again to see what we can do to make sure everybody has equal access.
Probably more important than ever.
The second thing I'm going to focus on is technology. With the advances in technology and lawyers, for example, we all have smartphones. Most lawyers do. There's no reason why we shouldn't have apps that can link us right to the rules of professional conduct or the rules of court or statutes and case law and other things like that. And this would all be hopefully provided by the bar to members to make their practices easier and to make them more effective lawyers. And then finally, because I have the good fortune of being president of the state bar during the state centennial, that I'd like to use the opportunity to celebrate 100 years of lawyers serving Arizona. And the bar has only been organized since 1933, but we know from the history books that lawyers have been here in the state since the territorial days doing great things, including helping draft our Constitution and the laws that
are still. You bring up a good point there that I hadn't really thought about until you said it, but when you think about the span of time, it really has been amazing. 100 years ago, there probably weren't even law schools. Clearly in the state, there weren't any law schools. The state, you know, may not have existed.
There was not.
But even lawyers, I guess there were lawyers who would read the laws, Abe Lincoln did. But when you think about how that's transitioned now, it's truly a remarkable thing, isn't it, how far we've come.
It is, and you're absolutely right. A lot of these lawyers, if you look back, some of the lawyers that sat during the Arizona Constitutional Convention may have, in fact, been trained by judges or other lawyers or taken the bar in another state. But the profession has been around a long time, as you and I know. So I think it's a good opportunity to celebrate what lawyers have done for the state of Arizona, what role we play in the state.
Speaking of which, tell us about your time at the governor's office before our next break here. What is the most interesting thing you take away from that job?
What's
the most interesting? Yeah, I'm sure there were a lot of things, but
I was with the governor. She took me with her when she became governor, so I was with her up until just 2-3 weeks ago. Dennis, I have to say that probably was the about two and a half of the most intense years of my life.
Well, I know you worked very hard there.
And it was an amazing experience. I recognize that very few people would get the opportunity to serve a governor in that way. It was an honor to serve her, and it was an incredible experience. The things the things that a governor...
And you like the governor, right?
Oh, I love the governor. Yeah. And she's been very, very good to me. I've enjoyed working with her. I think I was her longest-serving, direct-serving employee at the time I left. I'd been with her almost 8 years.
What's the quality you most like about her?
The governor is a person of high integrity, and she is a caring person. She wants to do what's best for the state of Arizona. She is conservative, but she will always do what she believes is the right thing for the citizens, and that squares fully with my philosophy on life and politics. So it just was always a great fit, and I just enjoyed working for her. I liked her style. I liked her directness. I liked the fact that she was very sympathetic, empathetic to the people that she was elected to serve, and that she's a workhorse. You know, she takes everything that is thrown at her very seriously, every issue that is thrown at her, and they weigh on her. So, you know, I thought that...
Did you ever think when you worked for her at the Secretary of State's office, she'd be governor?
I didn't. You know, I always just historically, you know, you think about those things because we've had so many secretaries of state become governor for different reasons. So there was always that thought in the back of my head that at a moment's notice, Secretary Brewer could be Governor Brewer. But we had a lot on our plate downstairs, so we were pretty focused on trying to run our state's elections and all the other business services and notary kind of requirements that the Secretary of State has to deal with.
All right, we're going to take another break. This is Dennis Woolencheck on Legalese with Joe Canefield, and we'll return after these brief messages.
I'm Steve Malzberg. Listen to me from 1 to 3 every weekday afternoon on the 50,000-watt Voice of the Valley, KFNX, News Talk Radio 1100, Phoenix.
CNN Radio. I'm Barbara Hall. New pressure tonight on New York Congressman Anthony Weiner as the online sex scandal surrounding him grows. CNN senior congressional correspondent Dana Bash reports some high-level members of the Democratic Party are urging Weiner to step down.
Congressman Joe Donnelly of Indiana, he said enough is enough. It's time for Congressman Weiner to resign. His actions have disgraced the Congress. That's just an example of what we're seeing.
Today, a new X-rated image purportedly of Congressman Weiner made the rounds on the Internet. A massive wildfire burning in Arizona's Apache National Forest has burned about 389,000 acres. Nearly 6,000 people have been evacuated. The UN Security Council is debating how to respond to Syria's deadly crackdown on dissent. The proposed resolution condemns the violence, but doesn't call for military action. The most trusted name in news, this is CNN Radio.
Arizona News Radio. The evacuation ordered in Springerville and Eager has been expanded. The 390,000-acre wildfire causing some more spot fires.
The fire is in fuels that are already dry.
Firefighters also battling the Murphy Fire, 67,000 acres, 25% contained near Aravaca, and the Horseshoe 2 Fire, 104,000 acres outside a portal. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms offering a reward for what they think now is an arson fire at the Greer Lodge last month.
We're soliciting information from the White Mountain community for any information they may have with regarding to the arson.
Four suspects in custody for a home burglary and surprise.
Two of which were adults, two were minors.
And a missing 18-year-old woman from Phoenix found safe at a friend's home.
Location I won't give out because obviously it's just a resident's home, but she was located here in Phoenix.
George Tanner, Arizona News.
And this KFNX traffic report is brought to you by 5-Hour Energy. Looking at the superstition right now, you're going to find two accidents heading eastbound. One's right at Mill. That one's on the on-ramp, but the other one's just west of Rural. And westbound on Shea Boulevard at 90th Street, you're going to find a collision there. Stay to the left to get by on that one. And Greenway west of 35th Avenue has a fender bender as well. 5-Hour Energy is the no-wait, no-hassle way to a great morning. Unlike coffee, there's no making, no waiting. Now that's fast and easy. That's 5-Hour Energy. Try it today.
Jim Howell from the KFNX Weather Center. We're going to remain below normal as we enter our second week of the month. Looks like about 98 tomorrow. And then we may see 100 by Friday afternoon, but we keep it in the upper 90s over the weekend. We're breezy down here in the valley and windy at times in the high country. Jim Howell, KFNX Newstalk Radio, 1100.
And currently at our downtown studios, we're sitting at 95 degrees. Next news in 30 minutes and when it breaks here on KFNX Newstalk Radio, 1100.
Attention women business owners looking for strategies to grow your business and build professional relationships with other successful women? Then we invite you to join the Phoenix chapter of the National Association of Women Business Owners. NABO is one of the five most influential organizations in the Valley, according to the Business Journal. We offer many networking opportunities, business education seminars, and a nationally recognized mentoring program. For more info, go to nawbophx.org or call 602-772-4985. That's 602-772-4985.
Are you interested in a consultation with Dr. Kondrat or one of his three-day programs? His three-day program is the best way to help you regain your vision loss. This comprehensive program includes an extensive diagnosis based on homeopathic principles, daily lectures on the essentials to improve your vision, and 3 days of intensive treatments. Take this important step now. Call 1-800-430-9328 to learn more about this special program. His three-day program is the best way to help you regain your vision loss. Call 1-800-430-9328.
First Option Lending, the people you call first.
So how are you going to use First Option's new no closing cost program? How about lowering your mortgage payment to save hundreds every month with no closing cost? Pull out the cash you need to pay off credit cards and other bills with no closing cost. Convert your adjustable rate mortgage to a low fixed rate. Convert your 30-year loan to a 15 and maybe save $100,000. You can even convert your 15-year loan to a 30 and pay no closing cost. Options are great. No cost options are even better. Call now. First Option Lending, 480-751-3400. 751-3400. That's 480-751-3400.
First Option Lending, the people you call first.
480-751-3400.
Business Bank Line, license 19017.
Dennis Wolinchek back on Legalese every Wednesday from 4 to 5 on KFNX, 277-KFNX is our number. I'm here with Joe Canefield, the outgoing counsel to Governor Brewer and incoming bar president. Those are kind of nice bookends there. You can't top that. But Joe is telling us about some of his experiences with Governor Brewer. And Joe, as I was asking before the break, we didn't get there, but what are your most fond memories of your experiences working as counsel for the governor?
Well, I think the most interesting experience, I don't know if a fond is the word.
Yeah, maybe that was a bad question.
Well, it was when in 2009, when we were having the budget battles with the Arizona legislature, and the legislature passed the budget but didn't present it to the governor. This was in early June. I think the thinking was that they would hold it, try to negotiate with her because they knew she didn't like what was in it. And hold it till right up till the end of the month because the fiscal year starts July 1 and there's got to be a budget. And they figured the more longer they held it, the more likely she was to try to see things their way. She, of course, wanted it right away as soon as they passed it and was, frankly, to veto it. So when that happened, I had to dug into the law books and the Arizona Constitution and decided that they didn't have the choice to just hold on to it. Once they passed it, their job was done. Constitution required them to present it to the governor.
And she has so many days to veto it.
Exactly. So in an unprecedented lawsuit, the governor instructed me to bring a special action, we call it, at the Arizona Supreme Court against the Arizona legislature, Brewer versus Burns. Bob Burns, then the Senate president, was the lead defendant. As also named was the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Kirk Adams. And to the Arizona Supreme Court's credit, they expedited things. And I think, if I can remember correctly, from the time we filed to the time the case was fully briefed and argued in front of the Arizona Supreme Court and decided, it was 7 days.
Wow.
And the court had, in a somewhat split decision, ruled in favor of the governor and held that the Arizona legislature constitutionally had to present those bills to the governor. But they also said that because the legislature had a good faith belief at the time that what they were doing was constitutional. They said they could wait until the last minute this year only.
But, I see.
So that in the future, no legislature will be able to do what they did unless we change the Constitution. And I think it was an interesting case because it was obviously high profile. We had all three branches of government in the same room at the Arizona Supreme Court arguing over the Arizona Constitution. And, and the differences were resolved in a civil way, and we moved on, and everyone got along. So.
Well, let's talk about that point, Dill, while you're on it. Now, obviously, the governor being a Republican, the legislature being controlled by Republicans, most people would assume that that would be pretty harmonious, but it's not always the case, right?
That's absolutely correct. And that goes to what I was saying earlier about the governor and just her integrity and who she is. And she is conservative, but it's a mistake for anyone to assume that she's just going to do something because the party has taken a certain position or certain other folks have. And she's going to do what she believes is right within the scope of her conservative philosophy. She had some serious differences of opinion about how to best spend the state's money in 2009, and it was with the legislature controlled by her own party. She stood her ground, and ultimately that's what the legislative process is all about. There's going to have to be some give and take. The legislature and the governor are both stakeholders in the legislative process, and they have to work together. So I think that she I truly believe to this day she did the right thing, and as I just mentioned, we moved on, and things were much easier and smoother the next year. So
do you think hard feelings get smoothed over in politics up there?
I would hope so. Politics is a tough business, and I have nothing but respect for those folks that go and run for office and serve, because it's tough. I mean, people can be very critical. You have to have thick skin. And even not only will voters sometimes be very harsh and opinionated and critical of you, but the same could be true of your colleagues, of legislators and other elected officials and business folks and people that are involved in the political system. But in politics, it's kind of like lawyering. You can be an advocate for your position, and you can be very good about it, but you got to set it aside from your personal feelings sometimes, because if you don't, you're probably in the wrong business, because it can be tough to do that at times.
Agreed. Well, let's turn our focus a little bit now to SB 1070, because in the news Monday, there was a story that the governor has hired former United States Solicitor General Paul Clement to argue the state's case in favor of Senate Bill 1070 with the U.S. Supreme Court. Obviously, you were integrally involved in this whole process. Now, you at one point were a Democrat, and then you changed to become a Republican, right?
That's correct.
So which side of that were you on, or do you want to say?
Oh, yeah, I'm happy to say. I mean, my history party affiliation-wise was I come from a split household. My father's a lifelong, very staunch Republican, and my mom is just the opposite on the Democratic side of things.
Must have made for an interesting dinner table.
Yeah, they just had their 50th wedding anniversary, and they get along fabulously. We just have to avoid the subject of politics sometimes.
Right.
I started as a Republican when I was 18. Was a registered Republican for 6 years. I think law school can liberalize people. I switched parties. And then I was a Democrat, and then I got into elections in the late 90s and really had to step out of partisan politics just out of fairness,
right,
and kept my party affiliation as a Democrat. I attribute the governor to my switch last year back to the Republican Party. Once we got to the governor's office, I didn't have to be so nonpartisan anymore. And, you change as you get older, and your philosophy, your personal beliefs, having a young child and other things.
Well, having said that, what do you think of 1070?
A 1070, I support 1070. I've obviously been on the team defending it. It's disappointing to me, some of the rhetoric associated with it, some of the things that have said about it that just aren't true, and what people say it's designed to do and what it does and what it actually was written to do and how it reads. And,
well, I think it's hard to probably take some of the racist kind of statements being made about it, right? That would probably be the hardest thing.
That's the hardest thing, and it's been probably one of the hardest cases I've had to work on because of the personal feelings involved with folks that are opposed to it. I mean, in every lawsuit there's people.
But it's very emotional.
Very emotional, and I found that some people just are unable to get past the emotion and focus on the legal issues, because they are serious legal issues involved here that need to be addressed by the courts.
So let's talk about this Supreme Court situation right now. So Snell and Wilmer, John Bauma, had been hired to represent the state and argued the matter in front of the Ninth Circuit. And I take it Tom Horn wanted to argue the case on behalf of the state. But the governor selected Mr. Clement. Who is he, and why should we feel confidence that that was the right decision?
Well, let me first say something about Attorney General Horn, because I think we have to give credit to him for his defense of 1070. You know, he ran on this issue. The voters elected him because of his support. We did not have the same support from our previous Attorney General. You know, frankly, I think that hurt him in the election for governor. But having said that, because of the dispute between then Attorney General Goddard and Governor Brewer, he was removed from any defense of the case. And then when Attorney General Horn came in January, the governor invited him to join the team as the state's attorney. So I can't say
so he is on the team.
He's definitely on the team. He's appeared on behalf of the state of Arizona. He's leading the counterclaim against the federal government. I don't want anyone to be left with the impression that he's not an integral part of this team defending Senate Bill 1070, as he said he would do.
We have about a minute before our next break, but tell us why, in your opinion, of course you're not there anymore, but why Mr. Clement then was selected and who he is.
Paul Clement's former United States Solicitor General under then-President Bush. He's a Supreme Court scholar. He's argued, I think, over 50 cases in front of the United States Supreme Court. He's a former clerk to Justice Scalia, who is obviously very important on the conservative side of the legal debate. He's a guy of high integrity and respect within the profession. And practicing before the U.S. Supreme Court is just a different animal. You know, there's a whole bar of folks that do this in D.C., and he's one of the best.
That's where he's based. All right, well, we're going to pursue that a little further when we come back from our break. We're here at KFNX with Joe Canfield, incoming bar president, and we'll be back in just a few seconds.
Since 1991, the law offices of Willinchek & Bartness have provided quality business litigation service that you'd find at a big firm with small firm atmosphere. Willinchek & Bartness specialize in cases of breach of contract, real estate litigation, construction defect, business fraud, and breach of fiduciary duty. For professional yet very personal legal representation, call Willinchek & Bartness today at 602-606-2810, 602-606-2810.
Has your growing business been putting off building for too long? If you need to build quickly, call Anthem Steel today and discover the Anthem Advantage. With a pre-engineered Anthem Steel building, you could save as much as half the cost and half the time of similar conventional construction. That's right, you could save thousands of dollars and weeks of construction time. And Anthem Steel backs your investment with a 50-year structural warranty. Find out why churches, schools, and businesses across the country choose Anthem Steel for almost any building need. From retail centers to manufacturing, warehousing, airplane hangars, and riding arenas. For free information, call 800-506-1707. Right now, you can save even more with rebates up to $20,000 on select sizes. Make the smart call to Anthem Steel today. 800-506-1707. That's 800-506-1707. 800-506-1707.
We've been talking to people about the work being done at Child Fund, an international organization devoted to helping children living in poverty. Here's what they had to say.
Child Fund is there. They've been there for 70 years.
I love the work that they do by building a school where girls can get an education and not have to be married off at such a young age. It's amazing that Child Fund is caring in that way.
They always seem to be looking for a long-term solution.
Visit childfund.org. Child Fund. Innovative solutions, one child at a time.
We're back. It's Dennis Willinchek on Legalese every Wednesday from 4 to 5, and we're here with Joe Canfield. Joe has served as general counsel for the governor, Governor Brewer's office, and has also, in about a week from now, going to be incoming bar president. And among that, he's also now counsel for the redistricting commission. Is that right, Joe?
That's correct.
We'll come back to what we were talking about before, which was SB 1070, but let me just veer off for 1 minute. What is the Redistricting Commission, and what is your role in that?
The Redistricting Commission is a five-member commission that was created by the voters in the 2000 election. They are tasked with drawing the congressional and legislative district lines following the census. So the census numbers just came out a few months ago. They have now convened as a body to start the process of redrawing the maps to reflect the change in population in Arizona. And they obviously need counsel because these redistricting.
That's a big job.
Yeah, exactly. It is a big job for them and for counsel too, yeah. Because there's lots of legal issues that come up. There's always lawsuits and there have been for decades.
I mean, it's an important situation because it really changes tremendously the landscape for elections.
Right, especially in a state like Arizona, yeah. That continues to see population growth. We'll pick up another congressman, and so they'll have their work cut out for them.
So let's come back to SB 1070. We were on it. We were talking about the governor's choice of hiring an outside counsel, Mr. Clement from Washington, D.C., rather than an Arizona counsel to handle it, or the attorney general. And you were indicating to our listeners that it was no slight against either gentleman locally, including the attorney general. Attorney general, of course, just coming onto the matter. The legislature actually carved out the attorney general from this process, did it not?
They did, and they did not – because of Attorney General Horn, as I was mentioning,
right.
It was because at the time Senate Bill 1070 was working its way through the legislative process, then Attorney General Goddard was very outspoken against it. So they felt that someone who so opposes the law could not in good faith defend it.
Right.
We all knew there were going to be challenges, so they very specifically said, well, the governor would lead any defense. She could still use the attorney general if she chose, but given Attorney General Goddard's opposition, she chose to go with a different firm,
right.
To defend the law.
All right, so where are we on that? When is that going to be heard in front of the Supreme Court?
We're in this petition for cert stage. That means we're in the process that we're asking.
So the court has not accepted the certification.
Exactly. So we Mr. Clement will lead the drafting of the brief that will be asking the court to take review of the case. That I think the deadline for that is July 11th, although we may ask for a short extension just because given Mr. Clement just came on board. And court will probably not make a decision till late September, early October.
Let me ask you something on this now. Why is it important that the court does take what we call cert, accept cert on this case, that is to hear it, out of all the other cases? Why is 1070 important right now? Why do we need it? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that because it's really important, because the United States government has chosen to weigh in and in an unprecedented case has actually sued the state of Arizona to stop it. And their whole purpose of doing that was to prevent and scare other states from following suit. So I think and a lot of states have been hesitant, kind of waiting to see how this plays out in the court. So we would, of course, prefer that the court take the case now and rule in the state's favor. And this would follow on the heels of its decision just a couple weeks ago upholding our employer sanctions law. And, you know, in my mind, the legal rationale and reasoning is consistent. We're not doing anything that the feds haven't invited us to do.
The employer sanctions law, we had a show on that. It's a little different because there's specific language.
Yeah, but it's true. But the general principles of preemption are the same. And there was a common issue, although the court didn't have to get to it because of the languages you were talking about. But to me, the general principles are the same about when you talk about no one disputes that immigration is within the purview of the federal government. And I've always said from the very beginning, Congress could end this debate with one sentence, but they've chosen not to. In fact, they've done just the opposite. They've invited states to help in the enforcement. And that's what you're seeing. Senate Bill 1070 is really just implementing what the federal government has encouraged states to do, which is assist in the enforcement of the immigration laws, and also to protect the citizens of the state of Arizona from the harms that come with an unenforced federal policy that allows.
But SB 1070 doesn't dictate that a law enforcement agency actually do anything, right? It's at their discretion.
It's at their discretion when practicable. and upon reasonable suspicion. So,
right.
And I'm glad you pointed that out, because that's one of the misperceptions about the law, that it somehow obligates police officers to racially profile people. That was never the case. As a matter of fact, Governor Brewer was so concerned that that was going to be the perception that she asked for language to be specifically put in the bill to make it clear that racial profiling would not be permitted. And when she signed Senate Bill 1070, with the same pen she signed Senate Bill 1070, she signed an executive order that required every law enforcement official in the state to be trained not to racially profile as a result of this law within the 90 days before the law was supposed to become effective.
Right. All right. Well, let's talk also now about some other issues. Having nothing to do with anything we've been talking about, we've got a few minutes left. Everybody has seen this story. If they haven't, they're deaf, dumb, and blind, I guess, about Anthony Weiner, all the jokes that go around about him. And now the revelation, I guess, is that some of that may be true. He may have done this texting. He's finally admitted. And now today we see a story that I guess his wife is pregnant. This guy can't get out of the news, I guess, right? And if you as an elections lawyer, how would you advise Mr. Weiner now, and also counsel to the governor?
Oh man, this kind of scenario just keeps people up at night who work for elected officials. And obviously, it was badly handled by him. And I have to confess, I'm not as up to date, not following the story as closely as I know a lot of others. I'm more concerned about the
probably wise that you don't.
Well, yeah, and I'm more concerned about the wildfires, frankly, in the state than I am about Mr. Weiner's situation. But it is unfortunate. If anything, it was badly handled by him. Now that he's obviously admitted to sending these texts, he should have just come out once he made the decision. Once it became public, he should have just came out, because all he's
done is the biggest thing, right? Is not to cover up these things.
Well, right, because in politics, you know, you want to try to, if you got a negative story coming, you want to deal with it and try to keep the news cycle as short as possible. But by lying or not telling the truth or whatever you want to characterize it,
should he resign now? You think, is this big enough for him to resign? That set a bad stage? Because, you know, I have mixed feelings about it. On the one hand, it's his personal life. Yeah. It hasn't affected, obviously, his work, hopefully. On the other hand, people lose confidence in someone like this who lies. So,
yeah, I mean, it's something he should consider. My feeling on it is, look, the vote, terms for congressmen are short, for 2 years. Judgment day is coming for him very shortly with the voters. And, you know, if he's able to convince them that this is a personal issue and doesn't affect the way he serves them as their congressman and they choose to reelect him, then so be it. But it's democracy at work.
Let's talk quickly about Mr. Clement again. He was involved in some other case involving the challenge to the Obama health care. Is that right? You've been involved in that too, right?
Right. And that was another issue that Governor Brewer had with then Attorney General Goddard, who she had asked the Attorney General to join the other states in challenging the constitutionality of Obamacare. He told her basically showed her the door and refused to do that. She called a special session, removed his authority to speak for the state, joined her 26 other states in challenging Obamacare. And now those states have hired Mr. Clement to lead the appeal at the 11th Circuit and the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's timely you bring this up, because this morning the 11th Circuit heard oral argument in the case. And although I wasn't able to listen because it took place, I think, in Atlanta, the news reports are that the judges had some concerns with the government's argument that this mandate that everyone purchase insurance is constitutional. And I've always felt very strongly that the Congress crossed the line under their Commerce Clause authority, that you can't force someone to buy something under, you know, Commerce. They have a lot of powers under the Commerce Clause, but this just isn't one of them. And I think that ultimately the states will prevail. And again, Paul Clement was hired by the states to lead this effort. He argued the case for the states today at the 11th Circuit, and he will continue to argue at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Now, speaking of the federal government, the governor obviously has met with the president on various occasions, which you being her chief counsel would be involved in. Did they get along personally? What's your take on that relationship?
Well, one of the high points of my service to the governor was actually staffing her when she met with President Obama in the Oval Office, and that was a real thrill. And that was June of 2010, during the height of the Senate Bill 1070 debate. She was out in Washington, D.C. for another series of meetings and had asked for a meeting with him. And at first he said no, as I recall, but then the press back in D.C. started beating up on him, and he changed his mind and found a half hour. This all happened very quickly. I got a call from from one of my colleagues on the ninth floor who was with her saying, Governor needs you out here tomorrow for this meeting. It was like 4 o'clock, so I had to get on a red eye flight. I thought the meeting went very well.
Was there any rapport there between the two of them? Or was it kind of stiff?
I mean, he's the president of the United States, and the governor certainly respects the office, regardless of how she may feel about his politics. I know that she respects the office, and I thought that the meeting was very cordial. You know, I couldn't help but find myself just reveling in the moment,
yeah,
being in the Oval Office and watching this take place. But, you know, there wasn't a lot of real substance in the dialogue.
Yeah.
I mean, they both he made his case, she made her case, and at the end of the day, we know where they both stand on this issue. So,
all right, Joe. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. We have been pleased to talk with Joe Canfield, former advisor, general counsel to the governor and incoming bar president, about his experiences. And it was a pleasure, Joe. Hope to have you on again.
Thank you, Dennis.
And good luck to you.
Appreciate it. It's a pleasure being here.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll talk to our listening audience next week, Wednesday from 4 to 5. This is Dennis Wolinchek on Legalese. Have a good week.
Join Brian Hageman, inventor of the natural energy engine, every Tuesday at noon for the Deluge Energy Report. Expert guests from business, government, and science discuss everything from energy policy to the price at the pump. Deluge Energy Report, Tuesday at noon.
Guys, I want to talk to you about engagement rings. Why is it that most of you are on the I Wanted To program? Last week, my fiancé said he wanted to clean the dishes for me, but instead left them in the sink the entire week while I was out of town. Or last year, when he wanted to take me to my favorite restaurant for Valentine's Day, but didn't, as we ended up eating meatloaf at his mother's house. So when he told my sister he wanted to buy me an engagement ring, she told him he'd better go to London Gold unless he wanted to hear the words no. Guys, this is great advice, as we don't want some overpriced run-of-the-mill ring from a corporate jewelry chain store. We want an original, unique, one-of-a-kind ring. And London Gold is the only place in the Valley where you're going to find that. So stop wanting to get the perfect ring and do it today at London Gold. Now with 3 Valley locations, Scottsdale, Chandler, and Glendale.
KFNX News Talk Radio 1100.
News, weather, and traffic.
Cave Creek, Phoenix. A division of Premier Radio Stations, LLC.